We don't have a bone to pick with Secretary Salazar. We don't have a bone to pick with David Hayes. This is not personal about David Hayes.
Senator Murkowski holds up an Obama nominee. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 13th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a treaty to help save the polar bears who roam between Alaska and Russia.
You know, the bear that we see today here on the U.S. side, 3 weeks from now, that bear could be on the Russian side.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by STEMS, where thoughts are sent with flowers and gifts can be blooming with color and aroma. STEMS in Anchorage at 907-563-3366. And by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski helped lead the Republican charge today to block President Obama's nominee for a top Interior Department post. David Hayes' confirmation as Deputy Interior Secretary has been stalled for months. Murkowski recently placed a hold on his name, saying she wants answers to questions about the Interior Department's directions. Her hold came on top of one by fellow Republican Senator Bob Bennett of Utah, who's upset by the cancellation of oil and gas lease sales in his home state. Despite the holds, the Senate moved forward today and voted on whether to proceed with Hayes' confirmation vote. It failed 57-39, with all but two Republicans voting against Hayes. Democrats needed three more votes to move forward. It was the first of President Obama's nominees to fail on the Senate floor. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar blasted the outcome, calling it a, quote, tired vote of bitter obstructionism. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's not looking to pick a fight and is instead seeking answers.
We asked last night, let's sit down, Senator Bennett, myself, Mr. Hayes, the secretary if he's interested, and let's sit down and talk about this. And I think we can work these issues out, a satisfactory resolution, put a hold, a 24-hour hold on this cloture vote. And the White House thought it was a good idea. We thought it was a good idea, and it was nixed.
Murkowski says she was hoping to avoid a showdown on the Senate floor and blames Democratic Senate leader, Majority Leader Harry Reid for pushing today's vote. But Reid and other Democrats say they've waited long enough for Hayes to get the job. The majority leader will likely reschedule it for next week when a trio of Democrats absent today may be available. Murkowski is concerned about how the Obama administration plans to proceed with offshore oil and gas leases in Alaska, and she's upset at changes made to Bush-era policies. Murkowski submitted 5 pages of detailed and lengthy questions to the Interior Secretary earlier this month. She received a draft reply last night, but says it wasn't enough.
I recognize that the questions that we asked are tough questions, but I also recognize that when actions are taken by the administration, you hope that they have done the thorough analysis and know what they are basing their actions on, and can articulate that when the questions are then asked.
Murkowski insists her hold is not intended to harm David Hayes or stymie the Interior Department, but Democrats join Secretary Salazar in condemning the delay. Alaska Democratic Senator Mark Begich says he wants to see Hayes in the job.
From my perspective, the Senate is still a mystery to me in a lot of ways. This is one of them, where I just think it's ridiculous that we just don't get the team in place. It doesn't mean we're always going to agree, but what it means is we have someone that we can actually work with.
Begich says David Hayes visited Alaska with Secretary Salazar last month to hear about offshore development and has shown he's ready to tackle related issues. So far, Secretary Salazar has only seen one of his department heads confirmed by the Senate. Political relations between the U.S. and Russia may be strained right now, but that hasn't stopped biologists from each country from teaming up on the Chukchi Sea to learn more about the polar bears that roam between the two nations. The collaboration is an important step on the long road to implementing a treaty signed between the U.S. and Russia almost a decade ago. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
It's not exactly human nature to be calm and collected next to a several hundred-pound polar bear, even if it is sedated. But Nikita Ovsyannikov and Eric Regier don't show a hint of concern, even as the animal wiggles around a bit.
Is he holding his head up already?
It's good that he's moving.
Yeah.
The biologists have years of experience working around polar bears. Regier for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Ovsyannikov for Russia. When they find a bear out on the ice, one of the most important things they do is measure it. To accomplish the task on this bear, the men roll out a tape measure that looks like it could have come from your local hardware store.
Are you ready?
I'm ready here.
I'm ready here. So it's 216. 216 even.
6.7. So that's the length of the bear when it's laying on its stomach from the tip of its tail to the tip of his nose is about 217 centimeters.
Or about 7 feet. The bear weighs 665 pounds, a young male. The biologists will take several samples from him. They even extract a tooth that will reveal the bear's age the same way rings do on a tree. Every mature female the biologists find is also outfitted with a radio tracking collar. They would just slip off the males since their necks are thicker than their heads. Last year, the biologists were able to track the movements of 9 bears. Regier says that confirmed they're international travelers.
You know, the bear that we see today here on the U.S. side, 3 weeks from now, that bear could be on the Russian side. They can have annual use areas up to an area the size of the state of Wyoming.
The bears the biologists found this spring appeared to be in good condition. Many had full stomachs, fresh off a meal of ringed or bearded seal. But Ovsyannikov says several weeks of good sea ice for hunting isn't enough to sustain the population long term.
On one hand, when they have these good ice habitats like here in spring, they can recover very quickly. But when they are losing this ice, they go for several months starving.
Wildlife managers are hoping a treaty between the U.S. and Russia will help protect the bears. The document was signed in 2000, but is still grinding its way through the political process. Rosa Meehan heads the Marine Mammal Division of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage. She says one important goal of the treaty is to curtail illegal poaching in Russia.
One of the concerns we've had, and one of the reasons we were really pushing to get this in place, is that for a number of years, there'd been some unknown but perhaps significant level of illegal harvest in Russia. And that became a serious concern, and so it was another reason to really push for getting this agreement in place.
The treaty commissioners include one government and one native representative from each country. Meehan says it's a novel arrangement for Russia.
They've never had an agreement like this before. And they characterize it as perhaps the most democratic agreement they've ever been a part of. They're having a hard time figuring out exactly how to pull it off, but they're working on it, and it'll be really interesting to see how this agreement works out.
While the politicians figure out the treaty details, Ovsyannikov and Regier are learning as much as they can about the polar bears the two countries share. The information will help inform treaty decisions. Out on the ice, Regier keeps tabs on the young male bear to make sure he's doing okay while he's sedated.
Counting his respirations as well. So about 20 breaths per minute and a temperature of 103 Fahrenheit.
Ovsyannikov has spent almost 20 years living among this same population of bears on Wrangel Island off the northern coast of Russia. So many females build their dens on the island, it's been called the polar bear nursery. But Ovsyannikov says the decline in the numbers of bears since he's been there has been striking.
In comparing to 1990s, we found out that now, this year, there were at least 5 times less females denning on Wrangel Island. And Wrangel is the key polar bear denning habitat for the entire Chukchi-Alaskan population.
Ovsyannikov paints a bleak future for these international bears, but he says that's why both the scientific collaboration and the treaty are critically important. The first meeting for treaty commissioners is expected to take place this fall. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, convincing more Alaskans to become foster parents.
I think a lot of people that care and want to do it are almost, it's almost like they're scared of OCS in a way.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Fire crews continue to battle the first major wildfire to hit the Kenai Peninsula this year at mile 17 of East End Road outside of Homer. More than 100 firefighters, including smoke jumpers and helicopter crews, are on the scene. Officials are now evacuating homes closest to the fire. KBBI's Casey Kelly reports.
State Division of Forestry spokesman Matt Weaver says winds picked up around 2 p.m. The size increased from approximately 70 acres this morning to about 300 this afternoon. In addition, some spot fires have started to occur on the north side of East End Road.
The fire managers have pulled back into a more defensive kind of a mode. They're assigning squads to contain those spots. We don't want to let those get away on the north side. They're also doing structure protection on a subdivision off to one side of the fire. So total number of structures under structure protection now is approximately 20.
The increase in activity prompted officials to close the road at mile 14 and call for evacuations east of mile 16. Residents were being told to head to the Voznesenka School in the Russian community at the end of East End Road.
There are some evacuations that the state troopers are conducting in that subdivision adjacent to the fire.
Mike Flora's house on Moonrise Street at about 16.5 mile East End Road is one of those being threatened. He said that he and his neighbors were packing up and preparing to leave Tuesday night when the fire first started. Two of his sons, who live in other parts of Homer, came to help.
We had about everything we could grab in our cars and trucks that we had time to put in our arms and run out the door with. And you're making all these kind of peculiar split-second value decisions about which painting and, you know, which thing to grab.
Flora says he thought they might have to evacuate Tuesday night, but fire crews, who he says he can't speak highly enough of, managed to keep the fire at bay.
The fire was kept away from my house, and then the two or three houses below me looked like they were in trouble, but the guy started a backfire, and that was successful. So it was almost right at our porches here, and the backfire kept the main body of the fire away. It was jumping from tree to tree, and then pretty spectacular.
Forestry's Weaver says firefighters have been challenged by rugged terrain, shifting winds, and no shortage of dry grass and other fuels to feed the blaze. Even if they are able to contain it, he says Division of Forestry will be on scene for a couple of days to make sure the fire is completely out.
Oh, yeah. We're looking at several burning periods, and resources are continuing to move into the area, and logistically there have not been any glitches. So resources are moving from across the state down to the southern Kenai.
The cause of the fire appears to be electricity from a downed power line. Homer Electric Association shut off power to about 290 homes east of mile 17 after it started. HEA is working with Division of Forestry on an investigation. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Dry weather has prompted the State Division of Forestry to suspend burn permits throughout South Central Alaska. Open burn suspensions were issued from the western Kenai Peninsula through the Matanuska Valley yesterday. Anchorage bull burning has been suspended as well. Glenn Holt with the Division of Forestry in Palmer says three fires were suppressed in Matsu and one in Anchorage yesterday.
Most of the fires that we're getting are being started from burn barrels escaping. And most of these fires started up after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which seems to be the magic hour for really, really warm and dry. We had some puffy winds, and that, of course, helps fires to, it makes it more difficult to contain or control.
Sharon Roach with the Division of Forestry in Soldotna says the extreme fire danger is normal for this time of year when dead materials left from winter provide fuel that can be ignited by a spark.
Once the grass catches fire, it can spread very quickly. I have been to fires where a landowner with a garden hose has lost the fire into grass and couldn't catch it even with running water.
The temporary suspension of open burning includes the use of burn barrels, but does not include campfires or cooking fires.
because the people that are having these small fires are taking care of them and putting them out, and we don't want to restrict entire summer activity. So we're working with this.
She urges homeowners to clear debris from 30 to 100 feet around structures to help protect them should a wildfire occur. Floodwaters are receding slowly in the village of Tanana after the Yukon River crested at near record level yesterday. Julia Roberts Hyslop, acting executive director of the Tanana Tribal Council and lifelong Tanana resident, describes the flooding as major.
I've never experienced a flood, just high water that came over the road. Nothing like this.
Roberts Hyslop says the Yukon River crested 3 feet below the record level set in 1937. She says large chunks of ice floated into town and that roads and 20 to 30 homes have been flooded.
We do have families that are going to be displaced for a while. Probably 10 families are going to be displaced.
Roberts Hyslop says about 100 of the community's 250 residents evacuated before the flood hit Tuesday. She says the village anticipated trouble and was well prepared when the water rose.
People are starting to put their things up high. They got all of their food, you know, boxes ready. They had water stored. So we were pretty well organized and prepared.
A community meeting was scheduled for this afternoon to talk about cleanup and recovery. Roberts Hyslop says the Tanana Chiefs Conference and village leaders are in Fairbanks talking to legislators and government agencies about assistance. Water levels at Tanana began dropping after an ice jam downstream of the village released Tuesday. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says the jam backed up the same wave of meltwater that hit Eagle last week. That water and ice have flushed downstream. Ice was reported jammed in front of the village of Ruby earlier today. Ruby is situated on a hillside and not expected to flood, but area fish camps and cabins could be hit by high water and ice. Alaska is facing a shortage of foster homes. Yesterday, Amanda Mativier and State Representative Les Guerra organized an event to help address the problem. They want to inform Alaskans about foster opportunities with the state's Office of Children's Services. Mativier is the statewide coordinator for Facing Foster Care in Alaska. The group is run by current and former foster kids. Mativier is a foster care alumni and foster parent herself. She says she thinks there are a few main barriers for people who want to become foster parents.
I think a lot of people that care and want to do it are it's almost like they're scared of OCS in a way, or scared of, taking in young people who are coming out of severely abusive and neglectful situations. I mean, obviously children are going to be experiencing, the side effects and things of trauma. And so I think a lot of people are just scared of, bringing children into their home when they don't know what to expect. But a lot of the training that's provided for foster parents really prepares them for this.
How great is the need for foster parents in Alaska?
Well, we have, I think, a little over 2,000 children and youth in state custody statewide. About half of those are in Anchorage. And I believe the numbers they gave today, they said there's 600 foster homes in Anchorage. And there's about a little over 900, close to 1,000 children in custody in Anchorage. So for those who don't have foster homes, they end up staying in like emergency shelters like Covenant House or sometimes treatment centers or even McLaughlin until they can be placed in a foster home.
Amanda, what are you doing to try to encourage more people to become foster parents?
Well, today, for example, we just were asking that people, step up to the plate and call, and if they're interested, even just to check it out and maybe do some of the trainings and learn about, if this is something that's right for them. I think just raising awareness around the issue is one of the most important ways to get people to come forward, because I think a lot of people, know there's a need, but they don't know exactly, how to get involved or how big that need is.
You've seen the system from both sides as a foster kid and as a parent. What kind of insights do you have from that unique perspective?
I didn't have to experience the moving around between foster homes. I was lucky enough to have one placement and one foster family right from the beginning who really became my family. So I think my situation was unique in that sense. But then also now, I guess, being a foster parent, I can understand a lot of the fears that foster families have. Because OCS is kind of scary, and it's very invasive. They, you know, do pretty extensive background checks and come into your home and really sort of invade your life.
You mentioned earlier that when there aren't enough foster parents, kids end up in Anchorage, at least, in emergency shelters and temporary situations such as that. What about statewide? What happens to kids in outlying areas when there aren't foster homes available?
They also end up in shelters, too, if their community has one, or treatment centers, or sometimes they're actually placed in an outlying village, if that's the closest home. Or they might be placed, sometimes they end up bringing them to Anchorage.
If you were to pick a couple of the biggest challenges that you think OCS is up against, what would they be?
Well, I think number one is their ability to support foster families because of, you know, the high caseloads with caseworkers. I also think it's just they need to build, you know, partnerships and better relationships with people in the community, too, to raise awareness and to let people know that they're not so scary.
Amanda Mativier is the statewide coordinator for Facing Foster Care in Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. And by the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell HKM, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services, on the web at dowellhkm.com.
The recession has cost Sea Alaska tens of millions of dollars. Leaders of the Southeast-based Regional Native Corporation say it's still strong, but its investments have dropped in value, which will affect shareholders' dividends. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Sea Alaska usually makes a substantial part of its income from the market. For example, three-quarters of the corporation's $30 million in earnings in 2007 came from investments. But that didn't happen in 2008. Instead, the portfolio lost about $50 million. That's more than a quarter of its value. Sea Alaska Executive Vice President Rick Harris says it could have been worse. He says the corporation's money managers prepared for the recession.
We have a long-term investment policy that we follow. What we've tried to do is make sure that we were well-diversified in our investments, and I think we feel comfortable that we're going to see better performance in this year from those investment funds.
Sea Alaska, which has about 20,000 shareholders, just released its annual report detailing the state of its finances. Earnings offset about a fifth of its investment losses, leaving a $41 million negative year-end balance. That's a $70 million drop from the previous year, when earnings hit about $30 million. Shareholder dividends have been shored up by other regional native corporations. That's because natural resource earnings are shared through provisions of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. High commodity prices sent an extra $55 million to Sea Alaska last year. But Board Vice Chairwoman Rosita Worrell says that won't last, and investment drops will take their toll.
We don't think we're going to disappear, and shareholder dividends are not going to disappear, but certainly there will be a decrease in that unless the market does turn around more quickly.
Impacts on dividends are lessened by a formula that averages out highs and lows and bases payouts on value instead of earnings. Sea Alaska continued to make money from its timber and plastic subsidiaries in 2008, though revenue was down. One of its environmental services companies was in the black, while another was in the red. Its largest profit for the year, about $13 million, came from a buyout of its investment in a Southern California casino. But one of its larger non-investment losses, about $5 million, came from efforts to open another gambling operation in the northern part of the state. Harris says the loss was expected.
That's the investment process, and which includes the acquisition of property, the investments that need to be made to go through the EIS process, which is required in order for the land to actually be transferred into trust by the federal government. So, yes, there's an early-on investment in order to perfect the title and to get the land into trust, from which we then will be able to build a gaming facility.
One of Sea Alaska's Washington State subsidiaries, the Olympic Metal Fabrication Plant, lost money last year but continues operations. Another Washington subsidiary, a prototype developer called Synergy Systems, was shut down with a $4.5 million loss. The corporation took some new business directions this year. Harris says it started up a logistics subsidiary that oversees shipping and warehousing. Sea Alaska also began a business that markets and distributes sustainably harvested wood. It's working with a Brazilian product right now, but it's exploring certifying its own forests as sustainable. Worrell says that could lay the groundwork for products using Southeast timber.
We have entered that field in other areas where we're buying from an international market and making furniture, and we're exploring lots of different avenues, and we're looking at ways that we might be able to integrate some of our art so that people know that it's Sea Alaska doing these things.
Sea Alaska staff and board members are touring Southeast communities this month, meeting with shareholders about the corporation's health. They're also discussing the upcoming annual shareholders meeting, June 27th in Sitka. The ballot includes board elections, a vote on extra stock for elders, and a board term limits measure. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Sitka.
Noted physician and author Dr. Robert Fortine passed away Monday in Wasilla. He was 75. Dr. Fortine was well known both as a man devoted to Alaska Native medical care and as a medical historian. In addition to his work with the U.S. Public Health Service, Dr. Fortine was on the faculty of Alaska's WAMI program, which works with out-of-state institutions to provide medical training for Alaskans. Dr. Fortine also worked to establish the Amundsen Educational Center in Soldotna, which trains Alaska Native youth in construction skills. Mark Hill is CEO of the center.
Dr. Fortine was a visionary in seeing, having worked out in rural Alaska and having worked with the Native population from rural Alaska most of his career here in the state, had just a real heart and a passion to see opportunities for vocational education brought to those people or provided for residents of the rural parts of the state.
Robert Fortine served in the U.S. Public Health Service from 1961 to 1987 and worked as director of Alaska Native Hospitals in Dillingham and Bethel and as chief of family medicine at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. He was active in the American Society for Circumpolar Health and has authored several books on medicine in the far north, among them A Century of Adventure in Northern Health and Chills and Fever, Health and Disease in the Early History of Alaska. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Homer, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer, Zanny Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed, on the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.